Welcome to Failing Up, a podcast where we explore failure.
Why we're afraid of it, why we try to avoid it, and the success that can arise directly from it.
Failure comes in many shapes and forms. It can even mean different things to different people.
This show, Failing Up, intends to explore all aspects. These are the stories of people who have experienced profound failures that ultimately led them to something positive.
We hope this helps us all learn and grow. Thanks for listening.
My name is Eden.
And I'm Guy. So Larry Karaszewski, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Failing Up. We really appreciate it. We jump right into it here, Larry. And we'd like to start at the beginning. So you were born in Indiana.
Yes,
South
I was.
Bend, Indiana.
South Bend, Indiana.
And when a young Larry, what's he like? Is he a good student? What are his dreams?
I'm a pretty good student. I went to a Catholic school until the eighth grade, and so the nuns really taught me how to read and write. And so when I actually went to public school, I had such a huge leap ahead of everybody else.
Oh,
so
nice.
I was able to sort of not really, you know, pay attention in high school. And while I was in high school, there was a local television show that was kind of a comedy show for young people. It was right around the time that SNL was breaking, but it was before SNL and it was pre-SCTV, but it had the same kind of thing. It was a show called Beyond Our Control. And so I actually wound up on that show for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
And so I went to high school, but I really did this TV show in the Midwest. And and that's really where I learned how to write, how to produce. It was a bunch of people have come out of that show, like Daniel Waters, who wrote Heathers and Batman Returns, the woman who invented Blue's Clues, you know, the guy who wrote Adventures in Babysitting, the person who wrote Toy Story 2. There's a Dean Norris from Breaking Bad. There's a lot of people who came out of this weird, the South Bend, Indiana TV show that's actually quite funny.
When you're on the, well, first of all, I want to know how you got the show, but I also want to know if you're going to a public high school, you said, are you a celebrity or do people are like, I don't even care about
it?
No one cared.
It's one of those things where it was, you're not even a big fish in a small pond, but you had access to do it. I mean, it was a professional kind of thing where we wrote scripts on Monday and Tuesday nights. We had auditions for parts on Wednesday night. We rewrote on Thursday, built sets on Friday, filmed it on Saturday, aired on Sunday.
Huh. That's so professional.
Very SNL and SCTV.
So that's what it really taught us all. I think it's why all these people became successful is that they...
It was ingrained in you.
Yeah, it was a sort of you got things done. And it's weirdly enough, I'm listening to the Bruce Springsteen autobiography right now in my car. Bruce reads it and he talks about, you know, being in a band on the Jersey Shore and just having that work ethic of having to do it all the time and having to work with different crowds. And so by the time he actually became a professional or came out to the West Coast or started recording, he had spent 10 years being a professional musician.
Right.
And so it put him on a different level when he actually, went into see the record label.
So this was your Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours.
There you go. There you go. Exactly.
And so is that a public, it's on a public access?
No, it was an NBC affiliate.
Oh,
it
wow.
Was,
wow.
It was technically.
How are you not popular?
Well.
If you're on NBC. Somebody's watching.
It's not. No, here's the thing. It was technically a junior achievement project.
Okay.
It was a junior achievement project that we just treated like it was a real thing. I mean, we were sort of kings of the nerds a bit, but we had our own thing, and it was on. And it wasn't like people really watched it that much. You were sort of on a different level of popular. Where you weren't a football player, you weren't a jock, you weren't even the stars of the High School Musical because you didn't have time to do it. So you weren't a part of that high school thing, but you were part of this weird TV show. And on that TV show was a group of teenagers that you were extremely popular in because you were all in this together.
Yeah.
And so in that group, you had a great deal of security, and those people are still some of my very best friends.
Do you audition to get that?
You audition to get in. And it was kind of run by a guy named Dave Williams, who has since died. He died actually while we were making the show, and
wow.
That actually was strange enough. Instead of ending the project, it transferred more power to the kids. So at that point, we were writing, directing, selling the advertising time, doing everything. So it was really all done by the kids.
That's amazing.
That's so. I mean, did you ever feel like? I mean, I feel like this all the time, but. Like, oh, I shouldn't be doing this. Like, I'm not qualified.
Well, no, because it was really just, you were just you were so...
Because it seems like you were thrown into it, really.
You were thrown into it, but it was really just your own... No one cared. I really, you know...
And there was like, no pressure.
There was no pressure. And so if I went and saw some crazy movie, we would make a parody of it the next day. And so it was just more you were able to just work through your whatever you were doing. They had a great gimmick. The show had an excellent gimmick for comedy, was that the gimmick was that someone had taken over your television set. Mm-hmm. And so the next half hour... It would be channel switching. It'd be like you're switching the channel. So as opposed to like SNL bits, which will go on for 10 minutes or go on forever, we had the opportunity to, you would write a sketch, which would be, say, a minute and a half, mm-hmm. and get most of the jokes, get the point of the sketch. You'd turn a channel. You'd go to a different sketch. You could come back and pick up like three more jokes.
Oh, nice.
You know, so everything could just end on a joke rather than having to do that traditional improv comedy. It has a whole point to
right.
it, you know? And so where SNL has a thing where, you know, the sketches yeah. have to fit between the commercial breaks. We could just do bits and pieces, and if the bit stunk, we could just use it part of channel switching. We'd cut in for mid sketch and get like, you know, get the jokes
today.
Yeah, it's yeah.
There was no best. So even B roll was good essentially.
Yes, correct.
That's great.
And I'm just picturing it now. So as the sketches went on, there'd just be like a click and a little static for a second.
Correct.
And then
you got it.
That's
you got
awesome.
It. And the static and the click actually was almost like a drum roll, in a sense, a punchline.
Right.
You know, you knew when you were writing the sketch that was a line you'd get out on, and you could almost hear the channel switch
That's
in
so
your head.
Funny.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun.
That sounds like so much fun, yeah.
But it also sounds like a lot of work in high school.
Yes, it does.
So you said you didn't really care about high school, like right. classes that much, but how do you even find, I mean, is that all you did otherwise outside?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all I did.
I'm serious.
Yeah, no, it was all I did.
And then... You actually, so then did you just move out to Southern California for college or how did you?
No, I mean, I was the first person in my family to go to college. My dad, I don't think my dad went to high school. My dad was a factory worker. My mom worked in a restaurant. She became a restaurant manager. And so it wasn't like there was someone saying to me as I was going to high school, even though I was doing all these things, oh, take the SAT or, oh, wow,
that's
you
good.
Know, right. go, you know, we're going to drive you around the East Coast and you're going to look at colleges. That never occurred to anyone. but I managed to get a job. The TV show was simply for high school students. So once you graduated, you couldn't be a part of it unless you became like an advisor. And some of the people did actually become advisors. And so you'd help them, shape the coming seasons. But I got a job working on the nightly news in that town, running camera and doing nightly news stuff, but also as their film critic. So even though I was this 18-year-old kid, I'd put on a little suit and I would have a tie and I would talk about the movies. And I did that for a year. And at the end of that year, I just knew I had to get out of South Bend. And so I kind of had two paths for me. I was going to apply to USC Film School or go audition for Second City. And I applied to USC Film School and I got in.
And that was the only place you applied to?
Yes.
Wow.
Did you take the SATs? Or
yes, I did. I had to. I think I have no idea how I did. I'm sure I did fine enough.
Yeah, obviously. And that's where you actually roomed with Scott Alexander.
Scott Alexander was a... this is going to be the dullest podcast ever or the most complete podcast ever. It's going to be an hour in and we haven't even got to Problem Child. Scott was... I got out to SC and I was in a dorm, and for some reason the computer, whatever happened, it didn't give me a roommate, and so I didn't have a roommate, and which was kind of cool. But I'll say a couple weeks into the semester, someone found out about that, and so the school started sending me people who were having problems,
right?
Like someone who got thrown out of a room or someone, and so all of a sudden I got a couple crazy people.
Oh my gosh.
And so it kind of got me a little
it's like
nervous.
Breakfast Club.
Correct. It got me a little nervous that like I thought I had this great thing where I had a room all to myself. Now I was going to have a room with, if it wasn't just one crazy person, it was going to be a series
a degenerate.
Of crazy people.
Right.
And I met Scott in line for you get that card that gets you food at the and it was a guy, he was in the film school. And we started talking, and we started talking about Herschel Gordon Lewis. If you know who Herschel Gordon Lewis is, he's he was sort of a filmmaker. What Russ Meyer was for boobs, he was for gore and slasher
okay.
things
mm-hmm.
In the late 60s. And so we were a little simpatico. And then I found out that he actually lived in town. He grew up in Brentwood, and so my scheming head said, oh, this is a person who would go home on weekends. And I'd have the house, I'd have the place to myself, right. but I also would have a roommate. So we manipulated the system so he became my roommate.
That's awesome. That really and then cool. now he's your writing partner. I mean, yes. still to this day, he's Correct. Your writing partner.
We wrote a script.
That's like
a
marriage.
We wrote it. Yeah, it's
longer than a lot of marriages.
We wrote a script like senior year of college. And it sold right wow. after we graduated.
Who does that happen to?
Well, what's
it
funny is
to Larry.
since you asked me all these questions earlier, it'll connect that like I came from this sort of blue collar family in Indiana, and I'm the first person to say, oh, I'm going to go make movies, you know. And they were always, well, what are you actually going to do? How is this going to happen? And I'm going to write a script, and it's going to sell, and I'm going to. But there was no real basis in reality for that, except for the fact that it actually happened.
Right.
It happened exactly like that. So it was one of these weird things where I was working in a record store, and I think Scott was working on like as a PA in a low budget horror film, and the script that we wrote actually sold for a lot of money, and we wound up having an office at 20th Century Fox.
Jesus.
Literally a month out of college.
Wow. Do we know the name of this movie?
Movie never got made. It was called Home Wreckers. It was about a thief who gets injured while he's robbing someone's house. But because he doesn't actually rob anything, he gets injured. He winds up suing the homeowners for negligence and taking them for everything they're worth legally through the system. And
right.
it was this will date it when I would say that it was in our minds we were writing it for Morris Day as the thief and Albert Brooks as the homeowner.
Wow.
And Walter Matthau was the grouchy next door neighbor.
Of course.
But that movie never got made. So we had this initial success, but that film never got made. But our next script was Problem Child.
Okay, but is that a disappointment when your movie doesn't get made?
Of course it is. No.
Getting paid does not mean anything.
No, I mean, it means something that you're able to make a living, but it always cracks me up when you work so long on the script and it doesn't happen, and someone says, well, at least you got paid. Well, you got paid, but you're, you know...
It's like you don't really see the fruits of your labor, really.
Correct. So you actually, you know, the only reason I'm doing it is actually to make movies and...
Right.
But whatever, you can make a living. You think it used to be a little more easier. Now it's a little tougher, but you used to be able to make quite a good living selling scripts and writing scripts, but never getting anything produced. But for us, it's always been about getting the movies made.
Yeah.
It's almost like you're knitting something. And you'll get paid to knit,
right.
but you're not going to see what you made because you didn't make
anything.
Or
the person's never, ever going to wear it. They're like, right. you know what? I'm buying that from you. I'm going to pay you handsomely for it,
right.
and I'm putting it in the closet, and I'm never putting it on, ever.
My clothing never makes anyone warm. It just sits in the drawer.
So you said Problem Child was
right.
your first. So right after that, so your next script.
Yes.
You guys have no scripts at that point that don't sell.
No.
Script one sells, script two sells, and it becomes Problem Child.
Problem Child was a pitch.
Okay.
So we sold,
okay.
I mean, there was a story in the, it's so funny, a lot of my projects or even the ones that don't seem like they're based on true stories are sort of based on true stories. Like there was
Was that one based on true story?
Well, there was a horrifying story in the LA Times about parents who were suing an adoption agency because the adoption agency had given them this child, and the child had been like thrown out of 8 homes and now this kid was like burning down their house and writing, you know, doing like pentagrams in his own crap, you know. It was one of these horrible things. It was, and I think a bunch of people in town read that story and said, oh, this is a modern Bad Seed kind of thing, and they pitched it as a horror film. We're the only ones looked at it and said it's a comedy.
Mm-hmm. And it worked. It was a humongous hit.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
What year did Problem Child come out? 1990.
Sure.
Yeah, that's what year came out. I mean, I still remember it. I mean, unbelievable.
Well, it's so funny. It's for years and years and years, it was something that we didn't lead off with. We were the guys who wrote Problem Child. But since the people who are now 10 are now, when they, that movie came out, are now in their 30s or
40s.
Approaching it. Yeah, yeah. They, you know, now it's one of those things where like, you're the guy who wrote Problem Child.
It's a classic.
They don't. Mm-hmm. They don't care about my good credits. They just like the fact.
Well,
that
no, you have a ton of good credits.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you two questions here. Number one, biopic or biopic?
Biopic.
Okay, really? I've heard a lot of people say that.
I've heard a lot of people say that, but I have no idea why they would say it that way.
Where'd they get that idea?
Biopic.
Maybe it's just a opic. Read
it sounds
wrong.
Like a yeah. It's
like a glasses
my
problem.
Nerve.
It's a
biopic.
It's a biographical picture.
Right.
So it's a biopic.
Yeah.
Right.
You know.
So according to IMDb, which I assume is you writing this.
No.
Your trademark is biopics of people who became famous for unusual reasons. If you didn't write that, would you agree with that?
Right, sure. What we always say is we make movies about, we write biographies of people who don't, write biopics about people who don't deserve biopics. That when we came before us, you know, biographical movies were sort of that great man thing, which were sort of, you know, it was Gandhi, it was Patton, it was those 3-hour movies that sort of sometimes were a cradle to the grave that sort of did, you know,
Schindler's List. Yeah.
It was that, this big heavy things that were good for you. And we sort of just took that template and recognized that it was a genre that needed its ass kicked and sort of applied it to the sort of the pop culture weirdos that we were, that we appreciated.
Wow. So you recognize that, like, you did something different, but that was a very conscious decision by you. I was going to ask you, like, what drew you to it, but you just told me.
Well, I mean, you know, you had sent me something saying that part of the podcast is about failures.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so, you know, what I would say, connect that to what happened was that, sure, Problem Child came out and was a big hit, but, you know, we had been fired on Problem Child. We had been fired and rehired a bunch of times. We never really kind of embraced Problem Child in a big way. And what happened was we would go into studios and pitch projects that we wanted to write, and they would say, oh, that's a really good idea, but you guys are the guys who wrote Problem Child, you know, that you,
was,
you know,
you were saddled with it.
We were saddled with it. And it was one of those things where we were only sort of after our first movie being told we could only write this kind of film. And that wasn't necessarily the kind of film that we wanted to write. And right. So what we did is we backtracked and said, well, yeah, we had that instant kind of success where we sold a script right out of college and we had a film made and all that kind of stuff. But we weren't happy where we were, and we weren't, so we sort of said, well, what if maybe we should have started our career differently? What if we should have been more the Sundancing kind of thing? And so we decided to write a movie from the heart, where we had talked about writing a movie while we were in college about Ed Wood and about the sort of the worst filmmaker of all time and his relationship with Bela Lugosi, and having this whole experience about Problem Child, where people, I mean, it made money, but it got the worst reviews ever. And there were people who just absolutely hated that movie. And so we felt like, you know, we could write a movie. I think the light bulb going off is to write a movie that was sympathetic to Ed Wood. That until then, Ed Wood had always been looked at as a figure of ridicule. It was sort of like the worst movie maker. Let's go laugh at his films. And sort of we sort of looked at him and said, yeah, you can laugh at him. But he came out to Hollywood. He so loved what he was doing, and he helped all of his friends, and he made a lot of features. And people don't do that. And he made them independently, and he made them just because he loved movies so much. So we said, let's concentrate on his passion. And we always thought it would be a sort of a low budget independent film. But it happened to land on Tim Burton's desk at the right time when Tim was wanting to do something a little different, and it got made right away and won Academy Awards and things like that.
I think it's like my favorite film of yours.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. And because we had been typecast as the Problem Child guys, we now were like, what is this thing? This and so we knew that. We at least had a brief window where we could probably come into a place and pitch something very unusual in terms of the true story, and it would get made. So we'd at least have a couple of these movies, and we pitched the Larry Flint film.
Right. Before we get to that, I have to say this. I'm sitting here listening to your story, and I'm like, you know, you're saying you and Scott, obviously. Yes. Like, you guys are, like, have you step back and gone, wow, like, you are clearly, I don't know the guy at all,
right,
but you're cut from the same cloth, obviously, because, you know, obviously you went through the Problem Child thing.
Yes.
I think that's something that could probably easily break up a writing team.
Sure.
No, and then you both are like, hey, let's go in this very specific direction, right? So, like, you guys are, it sounds like you're brothers from another mother, in a sense.
Sure. There's a, you know, there's definitely a simpatico thing, and that certainly at this point there's such a shorthand where, you know, we barely even have to finish a sentence, and the other person knows exactly what we're talking about. And there's certainly just words that we say to each other that actually, you know, no one else would.
It's a secret code.
Secret code. So, yes.
Do you fight?
All the time.
Good. That's
what?
A marriage.
Do you remember, like, the worst fight you guys had?
No, I don't remember the worst fight, because, I mean, what it is we are different.
Yeah.
And so it isn't a case of we both feel the same thing about everything. And I think it's that yin yang thing that actually makes our work good, is that we do have a lot of disagreements.
I think that's the beauty of all writing.
And it's probably a lot of compromise then in that respect.
Because otherwise, if he disagreed with everything, I mean, I don't think I also wouldn't have any reason to have a writing partner. He wouldn't have any reason, because it would be just, we certainly don't do it to save time. It's not like he gets, you know, it takes slower because we have to sort of work it out together. But it's the, you know, it's the fact that he brings something and I bring something. We bash it, and argue. And that, whatever gets on the page, we both wind up agreeing about it. And hopefully that's something that's a superior product.
Because, like, I had a screenwriting teacher whose, her writing partner was, like, totally different from her. She was Cindy Chupac, her writing partner. Okay. And she would tell me, you have to find a writing partner that can, like, learn to let go. Too, like, mm-hmm. if you're fighting over something, they can like if it's for the love of the project and for like the story and everything, they learn how to let go of their idea, and they're not like too attached to it that you can't move on type thing. But you want someone obviously different so you can, because you know, if you think one way, you're not going to get the other perspectives and the other ideas and.
Right.
So it's great that you found that person. I've also, recycled so many writing partners over the years.
I mean, I think a lot of times the reason why we've continued so long is that we're so slow that we've always booked kind of our next gig, so we can't split up because we actually owe that. I'm going to break up with you after that next thing, but the next thing it never actually gets done.
Does it make it difficult to just hang out and not do work things together?
That's called writing, I think. I mean, all we do is sort of the first half of our day is hanging out. We don't do that much socializing, only because there's so much professional socializing we sort of have to do, and also that we're with each other. I don't understand those writing partners who are there all day working, like, and then
some of them are married.
Yeah. Well, then let's go eat. That's like, strikes me as those fake people on a sitcom that I always see. We're like, oh, they're at work. Now they're at the bar. Now they go back home together. It's like, don't you people ever like go?
And for some reason, the door's always open.
Yeah.
So you brought up People versus Larry Flynt. So when it comes to these movies, one of the things that I really thought about was what kind of research goes into.
So much.
I mean, is that half of it? Like half of
Sure, I would say half of it. Sometimes actually even more than half of it. Or, you know, you really try to get just as much of the real story into your head as you possibly can. And then from there, you know, you have to figure out how to compress it into a 2-hour story.
Right.
I always find it very difficult when I'm researching something, how to let go of information.
Yes.
Because it's like, there's so much information on this. How much of this is really not that necessary? And which do I keep and which do I mean... how long do you think it takes you to research something?
Well, it can take it can take forever.
Years, yeah.
I mean, certainly the People versus OJ was insane how much we researched.
I feel like it's endless. Like, you can keep doing that.
You know, and here's the thing on those, on Larry Flynt, you know, a lot of our other movies, Big Eyes and Man on the Moon, and they weren't based on books. So we actually had to go and do the research.
Story.
We actually had to be basically journalists.
So do you sit down with Larry Flynt?
Yes. Oh, no, actually, no, we did not. We were afraid of Larry Flynt.
You were afraid?
We were afraid.
His
of
building's
Larry
like right there.
Exactly. At no point did you sit down with him?
Oh, yes. Yes,
oh,
yes, absolutely.
Okay.
He's actually in the film.
Right.
But when we set it up, the studio said, do we need to get the rights from Larry Flynt? And we said, well, actually, strange enough, you don't, because of the third act of the film, which is the Flynt Falwell decision, which basically says that you can kind of do whatever you want to somebody because of they're public figures.
Right.
It's one of the cases about free speech and being a public figure. So actually, Scott and I were one of the few writers in town. We actually sometimes are more friendly with the legal department of the studio rather than the development department of the studio, because
that's
we spend
rare.
So much time saying, oh, no, this line, we can say that because here's where Bob Shapiro actually said that.
Right. And see, that's one of the things that I was wondering.
Me too.
You know, I want to get to People versus OJ. I don't want to, like, get right. there
a lot of people
too
versus.
quickly. Yes. I know there was. Let's jump for a second before we get into the OJ thing. Right. Man on the Moon.
Yes.
So, you know, I think Andy Kaufman was a fairly known figure, right? When you wrote the movie, or no? Do you think he didn't really
much
have
the... I mean, he certainly was famous back in the 70s, but
I mean, I didn't know who he was.
Yeah, I don't think okay, people... Yeah, it was...
My dad did, but yeah, I wasn't alive when Taxi was around.
Right. And even when it was on repeats, I mean, people, if they knew him, they knew him as Latka.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you said, you know, the problem child thing. When I said I was interviewing you, people were like, Man on the Moon? Oh, my God. I mean, it's a great movie, too.
Well,
like,
Man on the Moon definitely seems to have a core. I think it's, once again, people who were younger, that was a Jim Carrey movie.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that's, you know, like when Johnny Depp made Ed Wood, for example, he wasn't Johnny Depp. You know, he was Edward Scissorhands. He wasn't the guy from Pirates. So I think a lot of kids, you know, they watched Ace Ventura, and then their parents were like, oh, Man on the Moon, it's rated R, but maybe we can put it on. And so it might have been, it introduced them to alternative comedy. Yeah.
I think it was probably one of my first rated R movies,
I think. That's what he's saying, essentially. So, and then do you get approached a lot? Like, are people like, do Lenny Bruce? And you're like,
the strange thing about our career is that if you're a normal screenwriter and someone wants to come and pitch you an idea, they actually have to have an idea. But they actually have to say, well, it's about this guy and he's doing this. When people come up to us, Thomas Jefferson.
You know? They just give you a name.
Give you $1,500 for
Hubert Hoover. You know, and it's like, well, what about Hoover? Well, that's what you do. You go figure it out. But Hubert Hoover, don't you think he'd be great?
And is that fun or does that get tiresome?
Never gets tiresome. Okay. It's I mean, it's sometimes you go, you know, most times. I mean,
I'm not telling you my idea then.
Yeah. I mean, the only time we've
Pete
ever
Sampras.
The only time we've ever instantly said yes to something like that was The People versus OJ. Is that we had never done television before, and Scott and I are very, because of all the research we do and because these things take much, much longer than a regular script, we are very picky about what we do. Also because I think we feel like we, for lack of a better word, kind of own this genre. We don't want to just like do things in that genre that don't represent what we really believe in. And the second we heard someone had bought the Jeffrey Toobin book and wanted to do it as a miniseries. And even though we had never done TV, we were like, yes, that's we went in because we thought it was a great story, but it was nothing we thought you could do as a movie. Because as a movie, it would be so just the greatest hits and
truncated,
2 hours and truncated, and wouldn't. What was great about the O.J. Simpson story and the trial was just all the just weird crap that went in a thousand different directions, and we knew that having ten hours would be able to do it justice. And so that was the only time we ever didn't even consult each other. We just said in the room, yes.
Wow. And you know, I actually have a really weird, unique relationship. I mean, not like you. I didn't live next door to Nicole Brown Simpson or anything. I hated the hype, the circus, and all of that surrounding the OJ thing. Mm-hmm. Didn't watch a second of the OJ coverage, the trial. Didn't watch the...
Really?
Didn't watch a single thing. I'm like the most ignorant OJ person in America, I think anyway. But of course, if I'm going to do research on somebody, I'm going to sit down and at least watch one episode. So, you know, and of course it's critically acclaimed and all that. So I sat down and watched episode one of People versus OJ Simpson. It's an hour. I watched three episodes of People versus OJ Simpson. And then I'm like, shit, I got to go to sleep. But now I'm going to watch the seven more episodes. But so for me, as a person who doesn't know anything, was really awesome. But I was also talking to my buddy, Tim Nuzzi, who's a former podcast partner. He's like, he was Mr. Every single morsel of information. He goes, I got to tell you, I watched the whole thing. I was surprised at the ending. He goes, I know how it ended. I still was surprised at the ending. I'm like, don't tell me anything else.
That's funny.
I know. And I'm like, again, I'm like the only person in America who hasn't watched the entire
thing. Nuzzi would eat that shit up.
He loves it. Yeah, I'm just... So
no, we knew when we were writing it that there were two very different audiences. I mean, there was more than that. But there were people who knew every last detail. And unlike some of the other people were doing, that if we got anything wrong in this, we'd be, you know, we'd be lambasted. And then there were the people who didn't know anything. You know, there were or like my kids who, you know, only knew O.J. Simpson as, you know, kind of that chubby guy who's in prison, and he supposed to have killed his wife. So they really don't know, you know, so they didn't know anything really about him. They didn't know what O.J. meant.
That's so interesting that like a whole generation of people know him as the guy who's just always in jail.
Yeah.
And like I kind of grew up like, oh, the guy from Naked Gun.
Yeah.
Like,
so that's actually why we added, you just watched the first three episodes, the very opening scene when he gets into the limousine.
Mm-hmm.
It's very brief, but it's the only time that you see OJ when he's not a murder suspect. Now, technically, he probably just murdered her and he's running back and being late, but he's in the limousine and the guy in the... And this is, once again, it's all based on true things. The guy in the limousine had never... He'd never seen a celebrity. And he never actually picked... He saw celebrities, but he never actually picked one up. And so it was the first time. And so we had OJ give a bit of a talk about, you know, about being a celebrity, about being, you know, what it meant to him when he met Willie Mays and things like this. And so all of a sudden in that moment, it just sort of connects you who this guy was before he became a suspect.
Right. And that's where that's right at that first thing. I'm going, okay, research. Like, do you have to have that conversation accurate? Does it really matter? And B, do you actually talk to the driver and say, what did you guys talk about?
No, we never, we'd done the OJ piece, we decided we were not going to talk to anybody. Only because some people were dead, some people weren't. Everyone involved in the OJ trial has written at least one book. Most of them have written three books.
Yeah.
So, and that's one thing we've also learned over the years, is that once people told their stories, that is the story that you're going to hear.
Yeah.
I mean, we are working on a project right now that I can't talk about right now, but we just talked to someone yesterday that we thought, oh, this... Thank God we're going to talk to him. He's going to unload. We're going to get some really goodies. And then we were asking him specific questions that that we never heard him ask before. And instantly those questions led to answers that were the exact answers to all the other questions he'd answered 1,000 times. So it was you can't shake it.
I think I remember Aaron Sorkin saying that he interviewed someone, I think it was for Jobs, and kind of the same situation. They were like just sticking to the story that they've been telling for years.
I mean, in all fairness, someone does a biopic on me, they'd be like, oh, that weird podcast, I've never even seen this thing. They'll put it on and it'll be, oh, those friggin' Larry stories, I've heard these 1,000 times.
Right.
Beyond our control. Yeah, who cares about that fucking TV show? Oh, the old biopics about people who don't...
If you're doing a biopic on Larry right now, just know we're calling you out.
So do you read every book that everybody does? Do you watch the old tape? Like, is it everything?
It's everything.
Who do you talk to?
Well, for
example... You must talk to
someone. Well, no, it depends on the project. For example, Big Eyes.
Mm-hmm.
There's no book on Margaret Keane.
That's true.
And we needed the rights to her art in order for the film to be viable. So we tracked down Margaret and we met with her and tried to convince her that she still was worried that people thought that her husband did all the paintings. And was very nervous about getting involved, and she's very religious, and she didn't want her religion being made fun of or being left out.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to, you know, really say to her that we first of all really believed her, mm-hmm. and we really thought it was a great story for today, and that we were going to include her religion as a part of it. And so that's kind of thing where we got all the stories from her.
That's good.
And then you do extra research as well. And Man on the Moon, I mean, practically everybody who's in that movie was an executive producer on the project. You had the real George Shapiro, you had the real Bob Zemuda, you had the real Lynn Margulies. That's actually one of my favorite nights in Hollywood. It wasn't Hollywood, it was in New York on the East Coast. We had an East Coast test screening that didn't go that well in Man on the Moon, and everyone went back to the hotel, and Scott and I went down to the lobby to get drunk, and we sat down, and there was the real George Shapiro, the real Bob Zemuda, and the real Lynn Margulies, and we're getting drunk, and we're talking about how things went, and Scott and I looked at each other, and we're like, we're getting drunk with our characters.
That's so weird, yeah.
We're getting drunk with our characters about the bad test screening about their
about
life.
About them, yeah.
About them, which is just freaking crazy.
That's so weird.
When you don't talk to people, like on the OJ thing, then I assume, like, you know, you read everything, you take everything in, but there has to be like some like cracks that you want to fill in with. Like, you don't want to call Marsha Clark and be like, well, were you thinking this? Like, we got everything else, but were you thinking this at this exact moment? Like,
that always is helpful. You know, what you also have to realize is that you know, we are creating drama out of mm-hmm. all these things. It's not just, we're not just plugging in research everywhere we go.
Right.
Yes, the, you know, I mean,
it's
the
not a documentary.
The, and the documentaries aren't documentaries. And yeah. you know, the thing about saying that is it's like
still
every,
an angle.
Every time someone makes an edit, it's a choice, it's yeah. a decision, and it has an attitude. So, you know, people always say, oh, document, you're, you know, and it's like documentaries aren't more truthful than what we do. But you, you know, you take the research, you take the pieces that you know, and then you create drama about it. And a lot of that is whittling away to just get the essence, because anyone's life is, it has,
there's, can so, do, many
there's so many different yeah. things. And so you got to turn it into 2 hours. And so, and even in the case of OJ, you had to take, the example I always use is the DNA evidence, which went on for months and weeks. That Barry Scheck did. We had to create a 3-minute scene that had the DNA evidence in it, but also had the dramatic elements around it. And even that scene I was just telling you about the limo driver. It's like the limo driver, you know, had said that he'd never picked up a famous person before, but there was no thing about his conversation with OJ. OJ, in other interviews, had talked about how the first time he met Willie Mays, and that was a big thing for him. Did he say that to the limo driver? No, he didn't say that to the limo driver.
Right.
But it was like the limo, we used the, because we'd done all the research, we were able to take what we knew about the limo driver and what we knew about O.J. Simpson and put them together and be completely honest, because they were saying what each person sort of thought and said and felt.
Right. I'm such like a dork. I love shit like that. Like,
I love it.
I
yeah.
love the origin. I don't know. Maybe right. it's just me. Well,
but I would say almost every scene in any of our work is that.
Right.
It's like, oh,
there's elements.
Yeah,
there's,
it's like making a collage.
Correct.
Yeah.
And trying to get to the essence of and keeping the drama going.
And I'm just curious. So when you're writing with your partner, do you guys, how long is outline like a big part of it?
Yes.
Do you guys have a very detailed outline?
Outline, we tend not to do what we call, I guess, a traditional outline. What we do is we do old-fashioned cards mm-hmm. on a cork board.
Yeah, yeah.
We find that much more...
It's kind of what I mean.
Yeah, helpful.
Yeah,
that we card everything out, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. And then we also have, we organize our research into these big books,
okay.
that will have, like, you know, so when we get to Larry Flint starting Hustler magazine, we can go to that section, and so when we're writing those cards, and all of a sudden there's some piece of information, we know where it is.
Because yeah, I noticed that the writing process when you're writing fiction versus writing something that's like actually based on real events is. That the outlining process seems to be very different to me, as far as I've right. seen.
Well, we write lots of movies that aren't,
yeah,
you know, the Goosebumps would be any different. You know,
right,
in a sense,
right.
we probably wouldn't have the book, but we'd have other,
yeah, yeah,
we have the R.L. Stine stuff, and we'd be doing the cards. The cards are great because they're, I think it's actually better than when it's on a screen or an outline.
Because you can visualize it.
You can visualize it. You
kind
can,
of
you
puzzle
can,
piece it around.
Totally. You mm-hmm. can look at it and say, our first act's too long, or this yeah. is, or you know, and
that's what
or
I do.
Or people, you know, I always use the example of, like, someone says that character is not working,
mm-hmm.
so you take a red marker and you mark every card that has that character in it, and you say, oh well, he's not. There's two rows where he's not in. Well, of course, there's a problem. What if we move this there or add this thing here? He can be in the background there, you know, and so all of a sudden you can fix things, you can see mm-hmm. things, and it makes just so much more sense.
Mm-hmm.
Is there so People versus OJ won 4 Emmys, right? Am I correct? No?
I think it won more than that, but I could be wrong.
4 prime, okay, maybe I'm wrong. Won many Emmys.
It was nominated for 22, so I think we won a lot.
Okay. Does that no, I mean, obviously it's
right,
amazing.
Right, yeah.
Does that make it better for, is that the project you're most proud of because it is the most critically acclaimed, or how much does critical acclaim, you know,
feed
into that for you?
Ed Wood won 2 Oscars. I won the Golden Globe for best screenplay for People versus Larry Flint, as well as people, you know, I mean, so it's like the, you know, it's more about what means something to you. I mean, I think the OJ thing is different than some of our other projects in that it just took over the zeitgeist in such a way that
well, it hit a lot of nerves.
Yeah,
yeah.
We when we were writing it, we always believed in it and thought it was like some of the best stuff we'd ever done. We just didn't know whether people were going to care. And going into it, a lot of people were very skeptical, thinking, "Oh, well, it's just gonna, you know, it." But there was a potentially for it to be kind of awful. We always thought it was going to be great, but we didn't know people were going to be able to recognize that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think we would have been happy if it just did well, but it did extraordinarily well right from the get-go. So people that have that kind of, and we also, it's a big difference between when you release a movie. So I've only done movies where you release a film, even if it's a critically acclaimed, you release at the end of December, and you've got even an Oscar season. Usually, if you release a regular movie, it comes out in October, and 3 weeks later, it's not in theaters anymore.
Yeah.
But let's say you got an Oscar kind of movie and you release it, and you've got 2 months or a month, and then it's kind of over. I mean, yeah. But with this thing, with 10 weeks, mm-hmm. for every single week, and I'm glad we did it that way as opposed to just throwing them all out for streaming, which I think, but people are finding it that way on Netflix now.
Right.
But it, as you've noticed, you've only watched three, but you watched them recently. Each piece stands on its own. Each piece is its full meal. And so it was great to have that, and then people talked about it for a week. And then that, and people talked about it for a week.
People did. I remember on my birthday this year, I think it was in the middle of it, and I was at my birthday party, and I hadn't watched it yet, but everyone was talking about it at my birthday party. I'm like, you guys, this is not about OJ. This is about me today.
Right.
So it took over the social scene.
Yeah. Well, it was funny. The our little... preview of that was that while we were writing it, we noticed that Scott and I would always joke that we ruined every dinner party we went to for 3 years, because when we'd be sitting down, well, what are you working on now? Well, we're doing this project about the O.J. Simpson trial. You know, my sister lived on Bundy.
Right.
You know, oh, you know who really did it? You know,
Puerto Rican guy.
So, you know what's really interesting, though? I noticed when I was watching it, I remember being a kid going to my friend's house. She lived in an apartment building and she had a doorman. And the way people talk about Trump these days, when they're like, oh, yeah, he's cool, but he's a Trump voter or something. I remember going to her house, and she's like, oh, yeah, my doorman's cool, but he thinks OJ didn't do it.
Right. Sure. Sure.
Yeah, it is kind of that same thing, isn't it?
And I'm like, this is really mimicking kind of, I mean, it's just a strange, like, social divide, too, which is very, you know, now it's also a question.
Well, it is one of those weird things where... I mean, it's one of the reasons why we wanted to do it. We felt that enough time had gone by that you could relook at things. Mm-hmm. But what really, I think, made it land home with a lot of people is just how much it felt like the more things change, the more they stay the same. So many of the issues that the trial brought up are still being fought out today. Whether it's the sexism against Marsha Clark, which was so echoed against Hillary Clinton.
That's what I saw.
Yeah, I mean, it was insane.
The guy's friends with Marsha.
Yeah, well, I'm not friendly. I'm friendly. We interviewed her a couple times on my old show. She's so sweet. I love Marsha. Yeah. She's so sweet.
She's very nice. We got to know her a little tiny bit late into the process. We instructed our actors not to contact the real people. Some of them did anyway. Marsha, Sarah did not reach out to Marsha until about episode 6 or 7. Basically, after it was kind of already happening, and she took her out to, you know, they went out to dinner, and then Marsha became a person that, you know, like Marsha came to the rap party.
Oh wow,
nice.
But like you know, Sterling reached out to Darden at some point and didn't get a response, and I think Garcetti had dinner with our actor as well. So I mean, there were a couple of people who did it anyway, but we were not encouraging it.
Okay. And is there a reason why you weren't encouraging it? You just don't want them to get tainted by that person? You don't want that person to say, I don't do that, and then they're self-conscious, that kind of thing?
A little bit of that. Once again, this is such a big thing and so controversial in so many... We just didn't want it to all just before we had what we had to say come out, that other people were already fighting against it. Whatever. Like on Big Eyes, we had Amy spent a lot of time with the real Margaret Keane, learning how Margaret held her brush, getting a little painting lesson and things like that. So often you will hang out with the real person, but we were just on this particular project, we did not.
I think it was for the better.
It. Yeah.
Worked out good.
Okay, let's talk about some of other projects. Now, I don't know where they stand or even if you could talk about any of them. So if you don't want to talk about any of them, you just throw me out. Are you doing something on Jonathan McAfee?
Yes. Jonathan McAfee.
Is that his name?
John McAfee. But maybe it is.
Maybe
Jonathan. He's a very fancy
person.
Very
popular. Yes,
yeah, I mean, unfortunately, a lot of these things I can't talk too much about. But that project is happening.
He's
in a way.
Super interesting character.
Yes, he's a very interesting character.
Is he out of the country?
No, he's here.
Okay.
He's here.
But there's something going on upstairs that's different, maybe, possibly.
Sure. We wouldn't be writing a movie about someone.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think Larry would even touch someone that's not interesting upstairs.
Well, yeah, he's an interesting one. Okay, how about according to, what was it, Wikipedia, you had a script about the life of Robert Ripley, of Ripley's Believe It or Not.
That was one of our favorite things we've ever written, and that's, you know, that's from a long time ago.
Is that not ever going to happen?
Probably not.
Was Jim Carrey ever attached to it?
Oh, yeah, it was Jim Carrey and Tim Burton in China, and it was about ready to go when it fell apart the last second. That's probably our biggest.
I'd love to see that.
Oh, it was fantastic. I mean, we were doing something new for us at the time, which was we were doing a sort of a biography of the real Robert Ripley, but at a certain point it became an Indiana Jones kind of thing where it was sort of like you learned a lot about the real Ripley, but there was a fictional adventure that he was going on.
Interesting.
And so we did that a little bit with Goosebumps, and that we had R.L. Stine as a character in the piece, and we were using the real R.L. Stine, but then making a fictional story about the real R.L. Stine.
Oh, sure. I've met him once. He's really funny.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's quite a character.
Yeah.
I know I have more for you here.
He's just trolling through my unproduced credits.
Everything I could possibly
find. I have produced credits you could talk about rather than my unproduced credits.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. But this is interesting, though. Are you doing something on Patty Hearst?
Yes. Jeffrey Toobin, that's actually our next big thing. Jeffrey Toobin wrote a book that came out this year called American Heiress, and Scott and I are adapting it into a film. And we're very proud of that project right now, so I think that's going to happen.
I was reading something, maybe it was around that article, there's some parallel with her and Symbian Liberation Army?
Symbian Liberation Army, okay. SLA.
And ISIS. Does this sound familiar? Something ISIS and... It's as
well,
if
no,
ISIS
I mean,
kidnapped
it's,
Jane Fonda. No, that's not what the...
But,
something
but,
around
but,
that. Charlize Theron.
No, I mean, it would be more like if ISIS kidnapped Paris Hilton or something like
there
that. You know, it'd be, I mean, so you had a person who was connected to one of the richest families in the world who got kidnapped by a radical terrorist group and wound up becoming
taken from the cop by the cops.
Exactly.
Clearly.
Oh, they know. And becomes a part of the group.
Right.
So.
And is it because of Stockholm Syndrome or is it not? And I'm assuming that's part of the whole story.
See the picture. If you can't wait to see the picture, read Toobin's book. Toobin is such an entertaining writer, and it's really been a pleasure to adapt him twice now.
When are we going
to
see this movie?
When you see it.
Okay.
Don't rush the writers.
Okay. You've been asked to do a Trump movie?
You know, it's one of those things where, like I was saying before, the
like everybody's asking.
It's one of those things where, like, oh God, I bet you're going to do Donald Trump next, or you know, I mean, it's one of the things I wouldn't have done OJ in 1996.
Right.
So
we'll ask you again in 10 years.
Correct.
Yeah. So there's like a two on the nose almost.
Depends if he gets reelected though.
Let's see how it ends.
Right.
You know, let's see how
we haven't
ends.
Gotten to Russia yet?
Yeah,
hold
exactly.
On.
It's like you know, we got to remember he's only been in office.
Isn't that nuts? It could only be another month. We don't know.
I know. Exactly.
And that's the thing.
And that's an ending.
Yeah.
That actually sounds like a good ending.
A great ending.
A happy ending.
A great ending would be at tomorrow.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you've done so much great things. Is there anything that you haven't done that you would like to do? And it could be not
related. Learn to fly. You know?
No, but...
I'm ready to die. You know, I'm just like, I've done it all.
That's it.
Well, no, we Scott and I were in a weird position where Ed Wood, Larry Flint, and Gandy Kaufman happened bam, 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 like just a couple years ago. And so it was one of these weird things where we had sort of our dream projects made, you know, right off the bat. So you have that thing where like, what else is up my sleeve? But I feel like I think we're on a real roll right now. I think the
I think you've been on a roll for a while.
Yeah, right?
I think we're on a roll right now. It's like
just for the last
20, 30 years. Yeah.
Well, thank you. That's very nice of you. But the I think what we've found is with OJ, with Patty Hearst, with McAfee. You take our eccentric style of storytelling, which includes a mixture of comedy and drama. I mean, that's what makes our stuff special is that it doesn't have one tone. And that's usually a big no-no in this town. They like to put you in a bucket of this is a comedy, this is a drama.
Oh,
definitely. But we mix it all together. And what we found with these other things, you throw in serious topics, you throw in guns, and it becomes a different kind of thing. It becomes actually it feels bigger, it feels more important. I mean, it's a little bit what we did initially with Larry Flint, where Larry Flint goes to the Supreme Court. I mean, there was a movie about a pornographer, and it had lots of silly stuff in it, but it was actually about it was grounded in a very serious issue.
Yeah. And then how do you end up doing That Darn Cat?
Before I answer that, is that a Keen over there? Or what's happening? There's a, I'm looking at a painting of a big-eyed
I know.
Of some
it's
kind.
Not a Keen.
It's not a Keen.
It's Israeli painter. Israeli. And you know, the funny thing is, I used to go to my parents' friend's house that are also Israeli. I'll live in L.A. And they had the like similar paintings like mm-hmm. that. I'm like, oh, God, you guys go to the same art gallery the same like weekend?
That's funny.
Yeah, it's from some kibbutz. We have like another one somewhere.
That Darn Cat was the last deal we took before we wrote Ed Wood. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those things back in the situation where we couldn't get jobs, or the only jobs we could get were related to Problem Child, and so you're going to write kiddie kind of comedies. And that's maybe the only thing that has our name on it that I feel like really, it doesn't feel like one of our pieces. It got substantially rewritten. But the initial plot, what we always thought was great, which was a cat who goes out at night, comes back with a clue in a kidnapping. And so they feel like by following the cat, they'll somehow... And so what we did was sort of... it was almost like a Twin Peaks kind of thing, where like the cat was able... You would do things in front of an animal that you wouldn't do in front of your other mm-hmm. people. And so by following this animal around town, you saw like behind the scenes of all these weird people. And so this young girl was kind of discovering how friggin' weird her town was. And so it was our script was a little weirder and more subversive than the movie that came out. But the Christina Ricci's in the movie. She's quite good.
I noticed in your Twitter bio, that's the one movie you seem to leave out. Is it just because you didn't have enough room?
It's not the... I mean, it's not the one movie I leave out. I mean, there's a bunch of things.
Okay, maybe there's not
one. But...
It's one of the movies. But I think you have like Problem Child and Problem Child 2.
Right. That's sort of thrown in at the end. It's kind of like The Professor and Marianne. It's kind of like it's like the good credits and this other crap that you might, but you know.
Do you have any regrets? Are there any, you know, like as far as anything you've done?
Or things you would do differently?
Oh, yeah. Everything you do differently.
Really?
You know. I mean, there was a period. I mean, for example, Big Eyes took us like 10 years to make.
Wow.
And so, you know, we probably should have... not been so just determined on that, and so there are gaps in our filmography where like what happened there, and that's because you know there were projects that didn't happen. There were like Ripley. There's a thing that sort of happened in the 90s. We made a bunch of movies back to back to back. In the 2000s, the studios became much more Spider-Man oriented, and there was a little bit where our films were always more independent minded, but we managed to make them made through the system. And so we had to Ed Wood was made by Disney. Touchstone. I mean, Disney made a movie about a black and white movie about a transvestite filmmaker. So we sort of had to refigure out how to do things, and that's how autofocus happened. That's how Big Eyes happened. We were able to do that through like the Weinsteins or Sony Classics, but it was definitely a learning thing that we had to do. And then we did American Crime.
Is there anything that you produced that or written that you think is underrated
that you'd like to, you know?
Here's one that people don't talk about because they don't really know how it fits into my our canon in a sense. 1408. Which is actually one of our biggest hits, but I actually think that we're quite proud of that movie, and I think that's a great example of a movie that you would think has nothing to do with our us personally, but I think we put a lot of ourselves into that film, and a lot of the weird. It was an interesting film to write because it really had no rules. Once we decided that once you got into that room with John Cusack, and the whole movie takes place in one room,
mm-hmm.
that there were no there it was liquid. He could walk into the other room, and it turned into this, and it turned into that, right. and that was just kind of a joy to write, and it was kind of a joy to make, and it was a hit. But I think it's actually, I mean, it's, and certainly in terms of how Stephen King adaptations go, I think it's in the top tier, and you know, I think that actually is a chilling movie. I think Cusack is amazing in it. I mean, I would say there are performances in several of our films I think are slightly underrated. I think Cusack's underrated in 1408. He's great. I think Kinnear gives an amazing performance in Autofocus. I think
I agree with, yeah.
You know, that I think you should have gotten an Oscar nomination for that.
I feel
movie.
Like a lot of your films, when I think about them, I think, oh my gosh, so-and-so was so good in that. I think it really brings the great actors in a lot of people.
Yeah, that, I mean, I think that's why we've been able to have the career that we've had, is because we're able to write parts that actors say, oh my God, I want to play that.
Yeah.
So that's been really nice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And do you always want to, is it a situation where you always want to do something different? Well, I guess it wouldn't be, because you've written, like, not that they're the same exact movie, People versus OJ, People versus Larry Flint, but do you ever get like, oh, we don't want to do any more like courtroom dramas, essentially?
No. Here's the thing. They're all really different. Yeah. I mean, you just...
It's not the same
story. You picked those two because they both have the similar title. I mean, we're just sort of aping ourselves for that. That's one of the reasons why that's one of the reasons we actually embrace this biographical genre, is that if you write family comedies, every single script you write is going to be, at the end of the day, about, oh, dad spends too much time at work. And if he only threw the ball with the kid, then it would be, there's some variation on that. If you write superhero movies, at the end of the day, they're going to have to
save the world.
That town square is going to be attacked. Where if you're doing a biographical thing,
so different.
Each film can be amazing. Autofocus is much different than Big Eyes.
Sure.
And so, but you can learn, you can take what you've learned in all those films and shape, and it helps you further the process. But it doesn't feel like you're just running in place.
If I'm a young guy getting into your genre, right? Mm-hmm. Let's call it your genre, biopics. Do you have advice? Is there a pitfall that I can avoid?
I mean, the pitfall is, you know, don't do Cradle to the Grave. try to find, you know, we always ask, you know, why is this person, why should this person be remembered? And usually if you answer that question, that gives you the end of your film. We try to cover as little time as possible.
Yeah.
You know, Ed Wood was, why would Ed Wood be remembered? He created the worst film of all time, mm-hmm. and he had this loving relationship with Bela Lugosi. So once you answered that question, you understood the time period you were going to be covering, because, mm-hmm. you know, Ed Wood had a long, long life. You're talking about research that you get crippled by.
Yeah.
You know, he made porno films and he did all this stuff. You could keep it going you keep it going forever. We sort of say, we're looking instantly for how does it end? How does it end in a movie?
Right.
Which is like a lot of times, you know, you need that sort of movie ending. And so we always like, you know, Larry Flint, you know, had that victory in the Supreme Court.
Right.
You know, and once you answered that question, then you realize, all right, if it's going to end in the Supreme Court, then the lawyer who took the case to the Supreme Court is going to have to be a major character. That's how the Ed Norton character gets written. And if you start asking those kind of questions, it allows you to create what your story is.
Right. Something just popped into my head. I had to look up because I forgot his name for a second. But as you were speaking, I'm like, I wonder if he was a fan of Paul Harvey.
Paul Harvey. Good day.
And now you know the rest of the story.
Yes. I certainly listened to him as a kid. I haven't listened to him in a long time. I've actually forgotten there's the rest of the story angle until you just said that. So you said that it's like a Proustian memory comes flashing back instantly. But yeah, Paul Harvey was gigantic when I grew up.
I didn't know really who he was. I used to catch him on, like, before Yankee games, actually. Right. I would catch him. And essentially, that's what he would do, is a bio on somebody, but you didn't know who that person was until he would tell this amazing story. And this person saved 6 people from a fire and then graduated summa cum laude the same day. And that man was George Herman Babe Ruth.
Right.
And now you know the rest of the story. That was my impression. Good.
That was not very good, but it was
okay.
Fine.
Well, I did
not
that.
Very good.
But then, not that many people listening to this know
what Paul Harvey sounds like.
That was an exact fucking Paul Harvey.
Although Paul Harvey had such a distinguished voice. I mean, it was like, it's sort of like an Ed Sullivan kind of person.
I almost did an Andy Rooney. It was really bad. Yeah, but okay,
yeah, that
fine.
Was very Andy Rooney.
But for me, I love that. Like, I just love that kind of shit. I eat it up. So I figured maybe there was some sort of like, yeah. Like, do you have? So that leads me to one more question. Is there an inspiration? Was there somebody that you read or watched or anything?
I wouldn't know if this is a direct inspiration, but it's certainly someone that I've gotten to be friends with, and I certainly looked at Simpatico, and he beats us by about like 10 years, is a cartoonist by the name of Drew Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
Him and his brother Josh created these they sort of really took on the celebrity underbelly. Mm-hmm. And Drew's probably most famous now for he did the Obama cover on the New Yorker, where Obama was in the, like, you know, George Washington thing, and he did a bunch of Spy magazine things, but those initial things he did with his brother, which were all sort of like the secret lives of forgotten celebrities. share a thing that Scott and I have, which is sort of the when most people do stories about famous people, it's all about just their fame and the what they accomplished, and it's more about the drudgery of every single day, or what the Freeman brothers did was about the secret racism and all this other stuff, where you actually like, you know, oh, that's what Fred Mertz would do at night, you know, and so that kind of stuff really, and to this day we become very good friends with Drew, and we're on this, we're on the world's greatest email chain with it's us, Drew Freeman, Leonard Maltin, the comedian, wow. Dana Gould, and Cliff Nesterhoff.
Jesus, like, I want to be part of this chain.
Cliff is like the world's expert on comedians. He wrote a book this year called The Comedians, which is fantastic. And so it usually ends up being three times a day you get some piece of Jerry Lewis trivia.
Oh, fun. But please include me in that chain. Yes.
Yeah, BCC, right?
It's an honor to be on that chain.
Yeah, that's amazing. And oh, what was I going to ask?
Well, you inspire me. No, so thank there you. You go.
Well, here's the thing. I'm here because you were just a random person that I found on Twitter, and I kept on saying funny things, and I kept on adding that little heart, and finally I said to you, I was like, I'm not a weird stalker person. Don't worry.
Yeah. He does. That's how I met him. So, okay. But here's something crazy.
How we all meet each other. Yeah.
Failing up listeners. Yeah. How am I verified and Larry's not
that,
verified?
I'm not verified. I don't know why I'm not verified.
I have zero awards. I have a cotillion award that I won when I was 14, and I'm somehow verified, and Larry's not verified.
First of all, I'm not quite sure what being verified. I know that's that check, yeah. And I have filled out the forms to do that, and I've been rejected a couple times because something like, oh, my photo's not correct. Or
crazy.
So,
I don't know how I got it.
But what do you get out of it other than the check?
Oh, here.
Listen, first of all, I got rejected, but I deserve to get rejected. You know, Larry. So the first thing is, people will follow you back just because you have a stupid blue check mark. Like, secondly, like, I'm serious, and this is stupid Twitter shit, but like, let's say you're replying to a Donald Trump tweet, for example. Right. If you're verified, when somebody clicks on that tweet and looks at the replies, yours are going to be at the top.
No. Not necessarily. Why are you saying this when you're not verified?
That's how I know. Because Nuzzy is verified.
He's on the outside looking in.
First of all, not everybody will follow you.
Right. Not everybody, but it helps. It does help.
I had a lot of very important people follow me way before I was verified. So I don't think that helps necessarily. It just makes it a lot. You can see who else is verified. That it kind of makes it elitist. You can see who else is verified, liked your tweet or retweeted it. So it makes it a little more... and you can put the privacy settings are a little bit more advanced, because a lot of these people do get a lot of crazy people replying, so you can mute a lot of people. It makes it harder to see people that aren't verified. That's a problem. Like, to see if guy liked my tweet, I have to skim through so many to make sure.
I'm a loser, Larry. I'm sorry.
But it's not a huge deal, and I honestly... I don't know why exactly they gave it to me, but
I never look to see if someone's verified. I just, you know, it's like, oh, it's Judd Apatow. It must be Judd Apatow. But I guess there are some people who are, you know,
the fake
accounts.
The truth is, I think they probably did. I mean, I literally woke up one morning and I got an email. They're like, oh, you're verified. I think it's because
you apply for it.
No,
they just verified you for no reason.
I think there's other people that were trying to be me or something, because I am like, I do funny. Like, I am a person.
Right.
Of some sort, and there is actually another Eden.
I'm a person of some sort.
Well, there is another Eden. Didn't I tell you there's another Eden that looks just like me and also Jewish and like everything, and like her tweets suck. And I'm like, I hope I don't get confused with her. So I think maybe that.
So now people know. Then know the real difference.
I think I just saw something you did that made me laugh, and I clicked on your thing, and there was like four things in a row that were just like, that's funny, that's funny, that's funny.
Tweet things that aren't funny.
Yeah.
But it's a good little.
Oh, I do.
I mean, it's.
At the guy DF. People.
It's a good open mic.
There you go.
It's where I practice.
Twitter's open mic for people funnier on paper. Sorry. But it's true if you think about it. Okay, Larry at Karaszewski, KARASZEWSKI.
I think that's why I'm not. That's why I'm not followed. It's because they got spelled Karaszewski. That's really.
Oh yeah, that's it.
That's it.
Oh, Baczynski. Yeah, both of you.
But see, that's why I'm the guy DF and not KARASZEWSKI. But follow him.
I say screw it. If Schwarzenegger can become famous. I know. And you've got that thing where, like, I always want to say Eden Danger rather than Dranger.
Oh, you have no idea. So, and my dad used to have a license plate that said Dranger, and people were like, oh, so you must be a psychiatrist, like Dr. Anger.
Dr. Anger.
It goes always. That's funny. Yeah.
You ever think of dumping the R?
Well, my mom's maiden name is Lifshitz, so I'm really glad I got the better end of the deal.
She married well.
She married very well on purpose. Yes. Yeah.
Dangerous her middle name, so she can't do that.
There you go.
So one more question for you, Larry.
Okay.
Do you have a favorite charity?
This we're not going to get another podcast.
I'm Donald Trump. my favorite charity. I don't have a favorite charity.
Okay.
Do you want to pick one?
Let's give you. Or do you want? I have a favorite charity. We could do my favorite charity.
Your favorite charity.
Okay. So one of my favorite charities anyway is Food on Foot, and it's foodonfoot.org. Essentially, this one guy fed a homeless person on the steps of the post office here in LA one Sunday, and since then it's been like 10 years, and he now feeds homeless people every Saturday and Sunday. And part of what they do is the people who volunteer to give out the food and the clothes and all that stuff, they the people who are homeless go out in the street and collect garbage. And then when they come back with garbage, they give them $5, $10 gift certificates to food stores. They can also get bus passes, which really helps homeless people get jobs. That's one of the biggest reasons homeless people end up homeless is because they don't have a way to get to the job interview, that kind of thing. So we're going to give $100 to Food on Foot. In your name, Larry.
That's so nice. That's so nice. See, the reason I didn't, I mean, my favorite charity is probably like the Cine family. So it's much better.
I love the Cine family.
I'm on the board of the Cine family. So like I give my things to Cine. So that's much better. The homeless people are getting it rather than we get an extra week of Godard.
There we go. So $100 to Food on Foot in Larry's name. And Larry, thank you so much for being on Failing Up. We really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for listening, everybody.
Right. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.